Happy Sabbath to all of you. Happy Sabbath to our visitors as well. As Mr. McKellar said, you look pretty good for such a long swim. I guess I am. The water is quite warm. It felt pretty good. And I suppose, you know, the trauma of growing up in such a large family, that one of the things I've noticed is that people from one or two, you know, they have one or two kids, the kids seem so much taller. Take a look at me. I can barely see over this lectern. But when you're from a large family, you get to eat, but you got to fight for it. I can remember Mom would serve a huge pot of spaghetti, be about like this, and put it out there, and there were all the plates around the table, and you would hurry up and get your dish, and you would eat very quickly. Because if you didn't eat quickly, there were no seconds. So it's a bad habit, even to this day, that I tend to just scarf things down rather quickly. I guess from years of thinking I was going to starve. So, anyway, we had 432 in attendance in Jamaica. And as Mr. Whitlark mentioned, 50 registered, but I think he said 53 may have been there. So that's a large number of people in Jamaica. And we had 9 days. We were there 9 days, and we thoroughly benefited from the feast. We thoroughly benefited from the people at the feast. We thoroughly benefited from the messages at the feast. I thoroughly benefited from the scenery, the site, the location. It was quite incredible. Very good messages, very good accommodation, excellent weather. It may have rained for a little bit, but there were short showers, and lots of food. I think I gained another 3 or 4 pounds. And so I'm trying to get back into a routine to where that will come off. Hopefully it does. Sometimes you get to, I know sometimes you get to a certain point and it never seems to come off. It's once you put it on, it's a battle to get it off. So swimming from Jamaica will do that as well. So I had my nephew Jacob and his wife Abigail, and they were in Jamaica with us. My sister Ginger, who lives in Washington State, she had 2 sons, one of which is Jacob. And Jacob married Abigail. Now, Ginger's husband is Stuart Fricke, and many of you may know Jeannie Williams. Jeannie is Stuart's sister, so there's some relationship there. Anyway, we thoroughly enjoyed them. We enjoyed a trip to Mystic Mountain and Dunn River Falls near Ocho Rios. And the Mystic Mountain, it's really a rainforest, a small rainforest. It's about 700 feet above sea level, and it's about 100 acres, a little more than 100 acres of property. The landscape is green, and you can see from the top, especially where the restaurant is, but also as you're going up, there's a, what do you call that, ski gondola. You're going up, and as you're going up, you can see over, and you can see down the ocean, and as you get to the top, there's a restaurant up there, and of course, we ate again, and it's such a beautiful view. The water is bluish in color, and it's just an absolute gorgeous view from that particular spot. We also went bobsledding up there. They have a little bobsled up there, and the girls and I went bobsledding. And then there's Dunn River Falls, which is about a 5-minute drive away from that. And it's spring-fed. It's a spring-fed river. It's 180 feet high, 600 feet long. And you climb it. You go to the bottom, and you climb it, and it's like stair steps of rocks, and you climb up it. And if you climb the whole thing, it can take you about an hour to hour and a half to climb it. And the water's cold. The water's very cold. Jordan and I stayed up at the top, and the rest of them went in the bottom and climbed up. But we stayed at the top, and boy, that water... As a little kid, I used to love getting in cold water. I can barely stand it now. But you get in that cold water, and just your whole body kind of seizes up. But at the top, the pools of cold water, and we got some pictures of Jordan and myself sitting in those pools and the water coming down. It was a beautiful thing, and we enjoyed those cool pools. What did you enjoy the most at the feast? What did you enjoy the most at the feast? That's a question for you. And maybe some of you right away have something that just percolates to the top of your mind. Anybody, what did you enjoy? Anybody, just shout it out. Family, sermons,
fellowship.
Music. Oh, that's a good one. That's one of the things. One of the things we had in Jamaica, the music was superb. It really was inspiring music, and we appreciate all those who were here that went to Jamaica and really served. That you made the feast. You just made it so much nicer. What else? What else? What else did you enjoy about the feast? Anything else?
Time
off. Time away from your work, whether it's mundane or enjoyable. Regardless, time away from that hectic, fast-paced environment that we are so accustomed to. I left, and I was telling Chevy before I came up here, when I left for the feast, I could feel the tenseness in my jaws, just muscles will harden. It took a couple of days and that relaxed. And now I'm back, they're starting to tense up again. Because you've got to prepare for an implementation, or you've got to prepare for close if you're in accounting and it's coming up, you're in it. Whatever career you're in, it is quite depleting at times. Quite depleting. So a number of things like that make the feast enjoyable. But I think one of the main reasons why I enjoy it so much, and this was my 47th feast. 47 feasts, I'm 52, so you count the difference. But 47 years, and reflecting on 47 years, I said, what has made the feast so enjoyable? And I boiled that down to the two great commandments. The two great commandments. It's during this period, I think, that we are greatly sustained with the intensity of living those two commandments more than any other time throughout the year. Now, Matthew 22 is where we read about those two commandments. So Matthew 22, verse 35. Then one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him, and said, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" Which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." So the totality of your being, you love him with you. And then he says, "This is the first and great commandment. And the second's like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So you take all the law, you take all the prophets, take everything, and those two commandments represent it all. Now, going to services daily helps us to refocus on the great plan of God and that He is offering to all human beings life. He will. Devotions by the seaside and the sheer beauty of the surrounding area causes me to reflect on God, that first commandment. You'll recall in Psalms 19, I read this during a feast, but I'll read it again because Psalms 19, when you're at such a beautiful place, what happens to your thinking? Psalms chapter 19, and I'll read this from the New Living Translation. It says, "The heavens proclaim the glory of God." So when you're looking at the heavens, you're seeing the glory of God. There's a proclamation that's taking place. "The skies display His craftsmanship." Look at what He's done. Look at His craftsmanship. "Day after day, they continue to speak." They're speaking. They're talking. "Night after night, they make Him known. They speak without a sound or a word. Their voice is never heard. Yet their message is gone throughout the earth, and their words to all the world. God has made a home in the heavens for the sun. It bursts forth like a radiant bridegroom after his wedding." You have the picture there. It's a lovely picture, like a bridegroom coming forth, coming out. And here it says, the sun does that when it emerges in the morning. It rejoices like a great athlete to run the race. The sun rises at one end of the heavens and follows its course the other. Nothing can hide its heat. And in the same way, nothing can hide its heat. Nothing can really hide the glory of God. It's there for all who are willing to open their eyes and see. If you are by the seaside like we were and you close your eyes and you hear the waves hitting back and forth. And, you know, I've got this thing on my phone that's supposed to help you kind of calm down at night. You know, it's called Rain, I think it is. And it's got the seaside going back and forth and you hear that and the birds. But there's nothing like being at a real seaside. There's nothing like it. You close your eyes and you listen. It's amazing. You hear the sound of the waves. You feel the gentle caress of the wind upon your skin and the warmth of the sun on your body. You hear the kids in the distance running on the beach, laughing and playing. You hear the birds. It's a beautiful thing. And it should cause us to honor and glorify God. So, that's the first commandment. That's the first commandment. And the second is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And as I said, at no other time in the year can we meet so many people from so many different parts of the world. Men, women, children, babies. We got our share of holding babies, and that was invigorating. And ways to express love to one another, from going together to an outing like Mystic Mountain or Dunn River, enjoying a wonderful meal with others, or helping someone that's fallen down on the beach, or opening a door, to giving a few extra dollars to someone that you know is running very thin. And you develop special bonds. Special bonds are forged at the feast. I know they're very special because I know people that go to the feast and they get married. That's a special bond. But that's not the only bond that's forged. You also shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, since the feast is over and there's buzz about, have you ever wondered why the buzz? Why the buzz? Why is it that we return and Mr. Whitlark has to get up here and say, ding, ding, sit down, please. We're about to start. Why is it? Because we're excited. We have stories to tell, relationships that we've developed, events that have taken place, and we want to share that, right? You want to share that. And again, I think for me, it comes down to the first and second commandments being intensified in my life. Now, the first commandment is vital, and if you don't get that right, you'll never get the second right. You and I have to get the horizontal right before you'll ever get, the vertical right before you ever get the horizontal right. That's important. It's very important. This isn't in my notes, but Philippians 1:20 is really my mission statement. Philippians 1, chapter 20. Let me read that if I can find it in this. All right. Philippians, let's start in verse 19. For I know that this will turn out for my deliverance. So here's one of the prison epistles, Paul's captive. I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Here's the statement. According to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing shall I be ashamed, but with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. What a mission statement. I want to magnify Christ in my body, whether I live or whether I die. Now, magnification could be done in a couple of ways, can it? If I had a magnifying glass, I could take it and I put it on something and it makes it larger, doesn't it? It makes it larger. I could look in a microscope and I might see a little amoeba, which is, with the unaided eye, you can't see. But I take that microscope and I look at it and it explodes it and I can see parts and pieces within this little cell. That is not the magnification that he's talking about. That would be heresy. That would be heresy because it's magnifying God, something he's not, into something that he is, that you see. It's more like a telescope. It's more like a telescope. You take a star that's light years away and you look at it in a telescope, and what does it do? It makes that star more like it should be to your eyes. So when we magnify Christ, we're showing him as he is. We're trying to show him as he is. You magnify him. You treasure him. You exalt him because he's everything. Isn't that Romans 7, verse 14 or so, where it talks about we are betrothed to him? He's our husband. He's our husband. So I love him. And if I love him, I honor him. I magnify him. I make much of him. Now, for some of you men, I know you don't like that kind of language, I love him. Just adjust it in your mind. Adjust. Do the adjustment. But I love him. And if you and I love him, we will magnify him. So that's the first and great commandment, but it has amplification on the horizontal level. You love God, and you love your neighbor. You'll see how this works. So I want to focus on the second, and particularly in the form of hospitality. What is hospitality? The Oxford Dictionary says, the friendly and generous reception an entertainment of guests, visitors, or strangers. The friendly and generous reception and entertainment of guests, visitors, and strangers. And in the Bible, we have the word philoxenia. Philoxenia. If you want an English transliteration, it's philo, and xenia, xenia. And it means love to strangers, and it's translated hospitality in the Bible. Now, you could see it in the word philos, friend, xenia, stranger. In help word studies, it connotes warmth, friendliness shown to strangers, figuratively the readiness to share hospitality, generosity, by entertaining in one's home, etc. Now, I could provide you so many examples in the Old Testament and so many in the New Testament. This concept of hospitality is just everywhere. It's everywhere. So I will leave that to you to go and just look at the examples. Look at the examples. But my focus is primarily on two texts today, Romans 12, verse 13, and Hebrews 13, 2. So let's turn to Romans chapter 12 and verse 13. Of course, Romans 12 is a great chapter because it comes down to the after you've been justified and sanctified, you've accepted Jesus Christ, what does it mean in practical terms? What does it mean in practical terms? And then chapter 12, verse 1, Paul writes, I beseech you, I beg of you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. There's something that has to take place. You're proving what's good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who's among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, but all members do not the same, they do not the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, and then he says it, given to hospitality. There's our word. There's our word. Given to hospitality. Given to being a friend to strangers. Now, the word given there is the Greek dioko, and it means to put in rapid motion, to pursue the direction, to follow eagerly, endeavor earnestly to acquire, to press forward. So this isn't just a casual thing. Hospitality is not a casual thing. If you say, well, I'm just going to do that once a year. No, he says, you earnestly chase after it. You hunt after it. You press towards it. You go after it eagerly. You're given to hospitality. So we pursue it. Now, I don't know if you noticed the words there in verse 13, distributing to the needs of the saints in verse 12. Now, the saints are simply those in Christ. It means fellow Christians. We therefore must pursue earnestly hospitality with fellow Christians. Now, this doesn't rule out in any way hospitality with non-Christians. It doesn't rule that out. Galatians chapter 6, verse 10. Galatians 6, verse 10 tells us, therefore, as we have opportunity, do you have opportunity? Do I have opportunity? Do we have opportunity? Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all. That's inclusive. But especially to those who are of the household of faith. So there's a priority that God and Christ give in our hospitality. We don't exclude others, but the priority is to the saints, to those in the faith. Again, it puts a priority on our fellow believers. This text tells me that I need to be prompted to press forward with hospitality towards you, or my natural tendency is to forget, to be consumed with other things, to be inundated with life, with my own problems, my own dilemmas, my own issues, my family, my work. We must press towards hospitality. And that's why he says, pursue it. You don't just receive it. You don't neglect it. You pursue it. Now back to verse 13. He says, distributing to the needs of the saints. Distributing to the needs of the saints. This was a special issue that was going on at that time in the church, but it's still applicable to us. Very applicable. Are there needs among the saints? Are there needs? Do you have a need? Do you have a need? Do I have needs? What's your need? Here he says, distributing to the needs of the saints. Distributing to the needs of the saints. Now you are my brothers and sisters. I do come from a large family. I do. But I'll have to tell you, many times in my life, people in the church have been more family to me than my own flesh and blood. That's a reality. You're my brother, you're my sister in Christ. That means something to me. I hope it means something to you. I hope it does. I really do. Because we should be hospitable. We should be hospitable to one another. And it says in verse 2 of that same chapter, renewing the mind to prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. Hospitality is that. Hospitality is that. But again, we get sidetracked, busy, consumed with other things that encroach upon our life. And we start thinking that hospitality is an imposition. It's a burden. It's a nuisance. It's a hassle. It takes away from what I want to do. Well, 1 Peter 4 speaks to this. 1 Peter 4, verse 7. 1 Peter 4, verse 7. Peter says in verse 7, but the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. And I would say, be serious about hospitality. Now, I'm talking to myself. I'm talking to me. I've got to get serious about hospitality. I have my reasons for a couple of years not to be as hospitable. But when I read texts like this, I have no excuse. What's your excuse? What's yours? As much as we have opportunity. First Peter 4, verse 7, but the end of all things is at hand. Be serious and watchful in your prayers, and above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. Because I could be up here saying this, and you feel pressured to be hospitable. And you've got to do it. It's a duty. It's a response that I must do. And grumble through the hospitality. I know. I'm like that. And I would bet to venture you are too. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. That word grumbling, it's a secret displeasure or a discontent. I really don't want to have those people over. I could find something much better to do. That's grumbling. And what's the opposite of grumbling? It is a cheerful and willing mind, is it not? A cheerful and willing mind. When we cheerfully pursue and practice hospitality, the needs of our fellow saints become much clearer. Do they not? I mean, when you're sitting across from a table from someone and you're talking to them, do needs not become more transparent and clear to you? I think they do. Especially as you come to know them and understand them and they understand you. It's not long before you are able to identify needs. Now the second use of this word and this form is in Hebrews 13 verse 2. Hebrews 13 verse 2. It says, let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. So verse 2 says, do not forget. We become complacent. We become forgetful. And we think that maybe hospitality is not that important. There are other things that are vying for my attention. So he says, do not forget. To say that positively, we would say, remember. Right? Remember. Remember to entertain strangers. Now, Barnes' commentary notes on this phrase, let brotherly love continue. He says, implying that it now existed among them, the apostle had no occasion to reprove them for the want of it, as he had in regard to some to whom he wrote. But he aims merely to impress on them the importance of this virtue and to caution them against the danger of allowing it to ever be interrupted. That's important. That's important. Don't forget. Remember, so don't forget. I urge you to remember hospitality among the saints. And then he says, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Now that's likely a reference to Abraham and Lot in Genesis chapter 18 and Genesis 19, where they were warned, they were defended, and they were protected by angels. they were blessed. So the writer says, you might be entertaining someone who's there to warn you, to defend you, to protect you, to bless you. You might be entertaining a messenger from God. What a benefit. What a benefit. You might be honored with the presence of those that will be an honor and a blessing, a warning, a defender, a protector for you and your family. Now, Matthew 25 goes even further than this. Matthew 25. Entertaining angels. But Matthew 25, verse 31, let's start there. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory, and all the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another as the shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And He will set the sheep on His right hand and the goats on the left. Verse 34, then the King will say to those on His right hand, come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave Me food. I was thirsty, and you gave Me drink. I was a stranger, xenos. It's what part of what makes up our word, hospitality. I was a stranger, and you took Me in. I was naked, and you clothed Me. I was sick, and you visited Me. I was in prison, and you came to Me. And then the righteous will say, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? When did we see you thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a xenos and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison or come to you? And the King will say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did this to the least of one of these, my brethren, you did it to Me. You did it to Me. So, do you see the Philippians 1:20 relationship? Magnifying Christ. If you exhibit hospitality on the horizontal level, you've done it unto Me, the vertical level. When we are hospitable, we are hospitable to Jesus Christ. That ratchets up hospitality to a new level, I think. And then, verse 43. I was a stranger, and He says, this is the other side. You did not take Me, and naked you did not clothe Me. Sick and in prison you did not visit Me. And they also will answer Him, well, when did we see you like this? We never saw you. And He said, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to Me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So, an unknown guest is more worthy than he or she appears. Do you get that? They are more worthy than they appear. Your manifestation of hospitality may be towards an angel, to others, to Christ. And again, that puts hospitality on a completely different plane. Now, over the years, I can remember my mom and my dad, large family, the salary that peaked in 1990 of $38,000 a year. And there were a lot of us, and at various times throughout our life when we were younger, there were more or less, because some would be going to college or some moving out of the house. And so you have a number of people there regardless. Now, if you adjust $38,000 a year for inflation and tax, that's about $54,000 take-home pay in today's world. Let's just say there were 10 of us. Could you live on $54,000 with 10 kids and a mom and dad? I told you we were hungry. I've read a few different places, and it's very difficult to live for a family of four. You go negative on $50,000 a year. It's very, very difficult. But one of the things I always remember is my parents inviting people over to their home, our home. We didn't have a lot. We didn't have a lot. All boys were in one room on bunk beds, and the girls had another room, and then my mom and dad had a room. We had a porta potty and an outhouse. And I tell you, I always tell this story because we had the porta potty in the house, and my mom brought it in for the girls. And my brother Lee and I, it was our job to empty that porta potty. And my sisters had no mercy on us. They filled that thing up all the way to the top. And so we would take it and dump it in the outhouse. And it was a messy experience. We didn't have a lot. I remember the table in the living room, and when we'd have people over, they would take a piece of plywood. My dad was a construction worker, and so he would take the normal table we had, and he'd put it on a big piece, put that big piece of plywood on top of it. And he had some benches. We had some benches along the sides that we put there. And then they would put a nice tablecloth on top. And that would serve as a dinner table for 15, 20, 30 people. It was, for me, I think one of the most impressionable moments of my life. Just those kind of events. Parents who did not have much, but they took the opportunity to be hospitable to others when they didn't have very much at all. One of the things is they, at least to my knowledge, they never worried about the cost of hospitality. I don't recall ever them talking about how much this is going to cost us. I never remember that at all. Never. Now let me give you some advice as we begin closing here. If you're hosting a meal, keep it simple. Keep it simple. You do not have to have a 22-ounce steak, perfectly marbled, generously flavored, bone-in cut, served on a 500-degree sizzling plate with multiple side dishes. Don't do that to yourself. Don't do that. Sandwiches and soup will do. Spaghetti with homemade marinara. Lentil stew, chili. One of my favorite meals is soup. I love a good soup. One author states, some people have two full-time jobs, working to support their lifestyles and creating illusions to impress the society and their peers. Don't do that. Don't do that. You'll make yourself sick. You'll make yourself sick. And in the ultimate sense, if you're trying to impress others, eventually, those people will depress you. So do it for the right reasons. Secondly, don't overwork yourself. One of the things that I have often seen are the nice dishes coming out, the wonderful wine glasses, the silverware, the dessert plates, a tablecloth that's regal, except for a king and a queen. That's nice. That is nice. But let me tell you something. Somebody's got to clean all that up. And far too often, it lands on the women in the family. Is that not true? It is for me. But I've seen it. I've seen people leave, and the dishes are stacked up. The counters are stacked up. That poor woman. Why would she ever want to host again? When it takes 4 or 5 hours to clean everything up. That's too much. That's just way too much. Don't be afraid to use paper plates, cups, plastic utensils. It's not about the venue. It's not about the place per se. It's about forming a relationship with another person that honors Christ, that magnifies Christ, that treasures Christ, that exalts Christ. The early church, I never have read where they had fancy tables, picture-perfect desserts. I've never read that. I've never read that they had wonderful dinners in coliseums, that there were brief, short little essays and short conversations. There were long conversations. They shared. And it was all built around the table. It was all built around a table. You go throughout the book of Acts and you read this sharing, this koinonia in the Greek, this fellowship. And so often, the church moved around the table. Thirdly, don't expect reciprocity. Don't expect reciprocity. Some people aren't able to reciprocate. They just can't. But some will. Some will. Now, if you're a guest, one, don't stay so late that your host falls asleep and goes to bed and you're still in the living room. That's happened. And they wake up a couple of hours later and you're still there. That's a little much. And secondly, although the host should not expect reciprocity, don't simply be a moocher. That's an abuse of hospitality. On one website, get the name of this, etiquettehell.com, it states, moochers, on the other hand, never seem to invest any part of themselves for the purpose of developing the relationship. It's take, take, take all the way. The relationship is excruciatingly one-sided. I describe it as I am the horse pulling the wagon or the sleigh while the passengers are having a great time. There are passengers who have no concept of helping to pull the hospitality load every once in a while. Nope. As long as they're having fun, you are of some value to them. But your true value to them is solely predicated upon how much fun you provide for them. Stop the party fun and the dinners, and there's no incentive to have a relationship with you. That's unfortunate. That also has happened in the church. Don't be a moocher. Don't be a moocher. And thirdly, If you're a guest, be willing to lighten the load of the host. Help pick up some plates. Is there anything I can do before I leave? And they say, no, it's all right. Help them. Help them anyway. Now, don't go into their sink and crash, boom, break this glass. That's not very helpful. Ask if you can help. Ask if you can pull out the vacuum and vacuum around the table, especially if you have a bunch of kids. Pick up some things. Put things back on the table as they should be. You can help. Offer your help. Now, hospitality can be many things. It's not just dinners or lunches or breakfasts. It's also helping others with cards, acts of kindness, lending a helping hand, and your age doesn't matter. Your age does not matter. Whether you're young or whether you're old, you can be hospitable. I know one of the things that I've thought about over the years is this concept of retirement. In the Western world, we retire and we stop. But you know, I wish that some of our retired members will be helping at Sabbath school. I really do. I mean, how many years have you been around? The experience that you have. You know just a bit about life, don't you? And not only a bit about life, you know a lot about God. Wouldn't it be great to pass some of that on? I'm sure the McDonald's, I don't see them here, I'm sure they would gladly welcome your help. In fact, the idea of retirement is foreign to the Bible. Sarah Lasco, in the business section of The Atlantic, addresses the concept of retirement. She wrote, in 1881, Otto von Bismarck, the conservative minister president of Prussia, presented a radical idea to the Reichstag: government-run financial support for older members of society. In other words, retirement. The idea was radical because back then, people simply did not retire. If you were alive, you worked, probably on a farm, or if you were wealthier, you managed a farm or large estate. So, Genesis 1, in the beginning, there was no retirement. You worked. Now, I do understand the concept of retirement and the golden years of your life and finding things that you love, have a passion for, find hobbies and things that you love. Do that. Please do it. You've worked hard. But don't forget the church. You have a lot to give. You have a lot to offer. Be hospitable. So am I living a life of hospitality? That's a question for you. Am I living a life of hospitality? As we started out on this message, I talked about the buzz of the feast. And what I'm saying is, if you want to maintain that buzz, be hospitable. Because it's loving the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, and your being. And it's loving your neighbor as yourself. I suggest we engage, we hunt after, we pursue, we prompt ourselves to press towards hospitality with a cheerful disposition towards others. Joan D. Chittister says, quote, hospitality is simply love on the loose. Hospitality is simply love on the loose. So after services and throughout this week and all the weeks to come until the next feast and even beyond, be hospitable and set your love on the loose.